Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 58, Archduke Charles, commander of the Austrian army.
We have a very special guest joining us all the way from Scotland, my good friend, Dave Holland. Say hello, Dave.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Dave is an author for several books in the Osprey collection, including Armies of the Napoleonic Wars, where he did a chapter on the Austrian army. And today we're going to talk about a very talented general from that army, correct, Dave?
Yes, he's probably their most famous general, and of course the victor of Aspern over Napoleon.
Yeah, Archduke Charles. If you'd like to learn more about Dave, where can they find some of your books, Dave?
Well, the seven Ospreys, and they're available from Osprey Publishing and all good booksellers, as they say. Okay. There's the ABC Clio Encyclopedia of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, which is a three-volume work. And it's, wrote quite a few contributions for that. And okay. Then Gregory Fremont Barnes' Armies of the Napoleonic Wars. And that's, I wrote the Austrian section for that.
Right.
And then also in 2009, there was a symposium in Vienna, and unfortunately I couldn't make it in the end, but somebody read my speech out for me. It's my speech is in English, and it was just called Archduke Charles, Who Was He Really? But the speeches were assembled by Ferdi Werber, that's F-E-R-D-I, and then Werber, W-O-umlaut, B-E-R.
Okay.
And in, if you go to his site, and then it's just Ferdi Werber Bücher, okay. And you can find the Zusammenfassung der Beiträge zum Napoleon Symposium, Feldzug 1809, im Heeresgeschichtlichen Museum, Wien.
I cannot tell you how happy I am that you pronounced all that for me. Thank
you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, like I said, David A. Holland is the author, and I'm super happy he agreed to join us today. And we're going to talk about Archduke Charles, who was one of Napoleon's most talented adversaries, wouldn't you say?
Yes, in many ways. He's a very, in many ways, he's almost the opposite of Napoleon, though. He's a great believer in sort of limited war. And whilst he was, he tended to view Napoleon as a kind of short-term problem, that the real issues were kind of Prussia and Russia in the long term. But he lost patience in 1808 when Napoleon kicked the Spanish king off the throne.
Right. Well, let's dive into Archduke Charles. He was born September 1771 in Florence, Italy, and he was the third son of Emperor Leopold and his wife Mary Louisa of Spain. What was his upbringing like? Obviously privileged, but what was it like?
It's rather different from what you might expect, because at the time, Leopold was the Grand Duke of Tuscany. It's what they call a secundogeniture, which is kind of, it's the emperor's brother would rule it on behalf of the empire, but it's not, strictly speaking, part of the empire. So he could pretty much do his own thing, and he actually disbanded the Tuscan army. And he's a liberal sort of enlightened ruler, and he knows by this stage that it's quite likely that he'll be emperor, because Joseph II, the current emperor, is having a few problems having children, so he's likely to be there one day. And he's thinking about things like constitutional monarchy, and when the French revolution began, he actually thought it wasn't such a bad idea, because it looked like it would become a constitutional monarchy, and he thought that renewal of France would be beneficial to Austria, because they were allied under the 1756 alliance. So it's a fairly typical Enlightenment upbringing. He's initially he's in with his older brothers, that's Franz and Ferdinand. Mm-hmm. And they're being looked after the Paola Colorado, who was a bit of a relic from the time of Maria Theresa. in the middle of the 18th century. But he actually concentrated more on Franz and Ferdinand. And so Charles was under the was more under the tutorship of a chap, a major from the infantry called Manfredini. And he's a kind of he's a rough and ready guy. He's done his 30 years in the army. He's become a Freiherr, which is a sort of a baronet. It's a, it's the minimum sort of type, noble title. But he and he's Manfredini organizes a program for him. And when he's young, he does the basic subjects like we all do at school. And then in the afternoon, it's kind of physical activities, starting off with games and that sort of thing. And then it builds up to sort of fencing and the things that the nobles do. Fencing, dancing, riding. He does. He's, and eventually he's doing quite a lot of riding because it's good for his rather poor health.
Yeah. And we'll touch on that here in a little bit. He was the younger brother to the future Emperor Francis II, his older brother. What was their relationship like early on and then as time went on?
They were quite close to start off with, but Franz is a he's a bit of a bit of a dullard in many ways. He's not that intelligent. He's he develops into what the Germans and the Austrians call a Beamter mentality. And a Beamter is a sort of low-level public official. We've met these, we all know these guys from our own local authorities. they're all rather obsessed with the detail and making an issue out of that without kind of being able to see the big picture.
Like a bureaucrat,
But the main thing was in 1784, when it was quite obvious that Joseph II was going to die childless, he had Franz brought up to Vienna and trained him in the Josephinian way, as it's known, which is kind of enlightened despotism, but it's all about centralization of the state, bureaucracy, administration, organization, all that kind of thing. But Charles stays in Tuscany until his father takes over on the death of Joseph II in 1790.
Right.
And so he carries on with this more enlightened education. He studies Rousseau, Voltaire, people like that with these kind of fairly liberal ideas.
That's an interesting point, though, because he never really planned or had to train to become king at any one point, right? So he could focus on other things.
He's part of this sort of Jesuit upbringing was that everything was ordained by God, and Charles was a religious person. He wrote quite a few religious tracts later in life, and so he believed that he was that the emperor was put there by God to do the best for well, the Habsburg possessions and also the Holy Roman Empire. And it was his job was essentially to do whatever he could to support the emperor. It's just that Francis was rather ungrateful.
And we'll get to that as well. Like you mentioned, he's well-educated and has a natural talent for military strategy. When did he receive his first baptism of fire in a battle? Was it pretty early on?
It was pretty early on. He was up in Vienna for a couple of years after his father became emperor in 1790, but he was adopted by his aunt Maria Christina and her husband Albert of Saxe-Teschen, and they were the governors of the Austrian Netherlands. That's basically Belgium and Luxembourg these days. And so he went up with them. And Albert took command of the army when war broke out in April 92. And we know that Charles was kind of attached to his headquarters. And the and there is a battle at a place called La Giselle, I suppose it is G-I-U-E, sorry, G-I-U-S-E-L-L-E on the 11th of June. But all we know from that really is that Albert sent a report saying that he was Calm Under Fire. So that's about that's about all we know about it. But in terms of he did have a spell with Hohenlohe again, with the headquarters when the Allies initially invaded. But I suppose in terms of having a real command, his first command was of a grenadier brigade at Jemappes.
Yes, which is a loss for the Austrians.
Yeah, I mean they were outnumbered about 3-1, and they had the French had a lot of heavy artillery.
Right.
But he did well. He was on the right wing, and the French basically smashed through the middle of the Austrian position.
Mm-hmm.
So they did his brigade performed very well. But
yeah.
they were just overwhelmed, and the French then marched on up to Brussels.
Yeah, but after that, at the successful battle of near Winden, he distinguishes himself, and he quickly emerges as one of the best commanders in the Austrian army. Mm-hmm. He did have one weakness, which was his health. He had epileptic seizures. Did these come upon him frequently, like on campaign, or when did these happen?
It's a myth that they came on him in battle. Mm-hmm. It's used by what they call the dynastic historians, guys writing biographies of him in the run-up to World War One, and they were excuses really for the defeats in 1809. And also Hilaire Belloc, who wrote a little book on Tourcoing. He relates a story of a British officer turning up to see Charles, who was told that Charles was indisposed as he was engaged in having a fit. But in actual fact, no, it's his health is actually quite well documented. Unfortunately, a lady did a PhD out in Austria, so it's all set out in there. And the epileptic attacks started when he was 7.
Mm-hmm.
But they would come usually when he was under a lot of political strain.
Right.
So you see it, it was particularly bad there at the end of 1800 when he retired from the army. Mm-hmm. And also 1804 when there'd been a lot of political infighting in court, and things like that. There's no evidence of it. In fact, Groon, who was his private secretary, and Hoser, who was his doctor later on, they both say he didn't have anything after 1805, but he did have a lot of physical problems. He particularly suffered from rheumatic fever, which is it's where your immune system attacks healthy cells and it makes your joints swell up, and it can affect your organs and that sort of thing. And of course, a lot of it's the result of the inbreeding.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you pointed out that, like, there's a difference between having a fit and, you know, an epileptic seizure when you're at home in your castle. That's a big difference, you know. So I'm glad you pointed that out.
And it's more a case of this rheumatic fever and other things would they would make him very tired. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have Napoleon's stamina, and the bone could just keep going.
Right.
Charles, he would get worn out after a campaign, and then, or even during a campaign, he would feel very tired, and he would often go to these spas and take the waters.
Right.
Or he went off on a long ride around Bohemia, 1801 to 2.
Yeah. So, but he lived a long life. He must have been overall healthy. Like, he lived a long time.
Oh yeah, I mean he was in good shape. I mean he was only a little bloke. I mean he was small, rather than Napoleon allegedly being small. He wasn't much over 5 foot. But he had quite a muscular build.
Mm-hmm.
But it is just this physical weakness, and it also a combination of things really. He had a rather depressive character.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, I guess things were going well, at least initially. In 1794, he's promoted to lieutenant field marshal and is active in battles in the Low Countries. This seems to be a hot spot for France and Austria, correct?
It's always said that Belgium is a creation of British foreign policy to keep the French out of the Channel ports.
Right.
Austria had taken the what were the Spanish Netherlands in 1714 under the Treaty of Utrecht.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of fighting there in the Succession War in the 1740s. Of course, they were allied to the French for the Seven Years' War, so it wasn't a problem then. But yeah, this was the first after the French had been successful at Valmy. This was their first excursion out of France.
Right, and I see why they would want that position, because that's right on their border. You know, they just to cover your northern border, you'd want to have Belgium occupied.
Yeah, well, it's the push for the Rhine, really. So you go up into Belgium, you then sort of think about going into Germany, but the terrain into Germany is harder.
Right.
Belgium is more kind of rolling countryside.
Right. You
see the pictures of Waterloo. You can see what it looks like. It's not too bad for crossing that area, and the roads weren't too bad. And of course, it was the ports like Antwerp.
Yep. Well, in 1796, he kind of finds his groove and he defeats the future Marshal Jourdan in a number of actions at Amberg, Würzburg, and Limburg, driving the French back over the Rhine. He also emerges victorious over a very talented General Moreau. What skills do you think made Archduke Charles a successful commander?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, he was quite lucky to start off with in that he was successful. He led the advance guard mm-hmm. at Aldenhoven and Neerwinden just at the start of March 1793. And he led the advance guards, and he led the cavalry. There was a decisive cavalry charge at Aldenhoven, which he led in famously with the Latour Dragoons who were actually raised in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And Neerwinden, he managed to hang on to the village of Doorsmail when they were having a hard time, and then managed to break out from there as Smola smashed up one of the French columns, and Beliovsky came into the flank of the French, and he attacked from the front, and that's really where the Neerwinden was won.
Right.
So his troops, he was there at the front, and of course he was there. He was prepared to go to the front. I mean, at Stockach, one of his grenadiers grabbed his bridle and said, "No, you can't go out into the open ground there because the French have got plenty of artillery and you might get your head blown off." and of course, there at Aspern, he rides out in amongst IR-15, grabs the flag famously, and he was out on the ridge.
Seems like an organized guy. Like, I mean, he didn't take unnecessary risks, but he knew where to position his men. He knew how to line them up in a good position. He just seems like a smart guy.
Being a sort of product of the Enlightenment, he likes sort of nice, simple, straight lines.
Mm-hmm.
He got rather annoyed with Mack, of course, because Mack's plans for Tourcoing and Fleurus all went a bit wrong. Because they were elaborate sort of six-column attacks that were going over bad ground and rivers and all this sort of thing. And the 1796 campaign in Germany is a very simple campaign. It's just based on the German road network.
Mm-hmm.
And so he liked things nice and simple like that. He did take a fairly mathematical approach to things, in terms of keeping his supply lines and depots covered. He's the main thing with him was that he was realistic.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of politicians and a lot of French generals as well. They all get a bit kind of carried away. Now we can do this, we can defeat the enemy, all this kind of thing.
Right.
Charles was realistic that Austria just didn't have the capacity to take France on its own.
Right.
And so it was the same with the battles. He would only commit the troops he needed to commit
Right. And I think when Vienna or the court would start beating the war drums, it always seemed to me that he was like the realistic one. Like, hey, no, we're not ready to take on Napoleon yet. Let's hold off.
Yeah. And I think right down the sort of tactical level. So his troops knew that they wouldn't throw their lives away unnecessarily. He would only throw in enough to achieve the objective.
That's a great point.
And he's kind of one of the last advocates of what you would call limited warfare, mm-hmm. before you get into Napoleonic and Clausewitzian style sort of warfare. And he was affected by the, particularly when he looked around the Aspern battlefield.
Yeah.
He was affected. He genuinely was affected. And I think he listened to his senior officers. He relied very heavily on his senior staff officers and people like Johannes Lichtenstein, his cavalry commander. So they knew he would listen to them as well.
Right. And that makes a big difference. Yeah. He kind of reminds me on the French side of a Marshal Saint-Cyr, like a mathematical kind of analytical guy.
Yeah.
Who isn't going to waste his men's lives on like fruitless assaults.
Yeah. He's the opposite of the likes of sort of Ney and Murat. He's not a hothead. He doesn't dress up in fancy uniforms. He was always out in a plain uniform, and he didn't wear a lot of decorations and that sort of thing. And he would ride amongst the men and they cheer him along. And of course, to some extent, they relied the army. You know, of course, they couldn't rely on nationalism because there were so many nationalities in the empire.
Right.
And so it was kind of this loyalty to the emperor. And in some ways, he personified the emperor.
Right.
For the men. So they followed him.
And despite, his great track record in 1796, he kind of meets his match in 1797 when he comes across General Bonaparte for the first time. Mm-hmm. And although Napoleon would go on to defeat Charles many times in battle, I think they met 5 or 6 times. Do you think Napoleon respected the Archduke's abilities?
It's always very difficult with Napoleon because he will tend to say what suits him. Really.
Right.
He would have been aware of it. I mean, obviously he would have known what was going on in Germany whilst he was in Italy in 1796. Mm-hmm. So he knew that Charles was a capable commander, but I suppose the most telling thing in many ways was that Jourdan, who Charles had defeated a couple of times, was the military advisor to Eugène de Beauharnais when he was the viceroy in Italy.
Right.
In 1805. And as soon as Napoleon got wind of the fact that Charles was going to be commanding in Italy, he pulled Jourdan and put Massena in his place. So I think he would have considered him somewhere around that sort of Massena level.
Gotcha.
Obviously not as brilliant as himself. And I think he probably felt Charles was perhaps a bit too cautious, but he did ask Metternich if Charles would command in 1812 in Russia.
Clearly he did not. No. So, yeah. In 1799, though, Austria was again at war with France, and Archduke Charles defeats Jourdan again and Massena at the First Battle of Zurich, but Austria was ultimately defeated by their losses at Marengo and at Hohenlinden. And this Austrian force at the last battle was led by Charles's brother, Archduke John, who was the less talented of the two brothers. Why was John not as skilled militarily as Charles?
It's a combination of things, really. I mean, at Hohenlinden, he was only 18 years old. So he was really just a figurehead.
Right.
He had no military experience at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a bit of a dreamer.
he very much
got into the kind of German nationalism that took hold before the 1809 war. He got behind that. But he was more like Franz. He wasn't an intellectual. He wasn't a bad administrator. He did a lot of work on the fortifications in the Tyrol in the run-up to 1805, and he did defend some of the passes there. And he didn't do too badly in Italy in 1809 at first, but of course he got absolutely hammered at Raab there
right
in the middle of June. So he hasn't got the experience. He hasn't got the ability, basically.
It's funny you mentioned the word dreamer, though, because like where Charles was a realist, I wonder if John was just kind of the commander would tell you, oh yeah, we'll be there in time for that battle, and then he wasn't, you know, like, and it seemed to happen a lot. Like at Wagram, he didn't get there until the very end.
Well, to some extent, I think Charles's staff were at fault for that, for not calling him in quickly enough. But he didn't fall over himself.
Okay.
I mean, there are stories about John perhaps thinking about what would happen if the Empire was broken up, and which he needs to have some troops to make sure he got a bit of it anyway.
Right.
And there is supposed to have been a scheme he dreamed up with Hormeyer, who was a sort of German nationalist poet idealist.
Interesting.
In the Tyrol, about becoming the king of, it's Raetia, it's an old Roman name for sort of South Bavaria, Tyrol, Northern Italy.
Yeah.
He's going to be the king of Raetia.
That didn't happen, apparently.
No. Right. I mean, he wasn't really, he was 10 years younger than Charles, so he's very much in awe. And just wishing, it's kind of a sort of mini me thing. I want to be like you, but I haven't really got the talent to do it.
Right. Well, moving along in our story, Austria was again humbled by Napoleon in the 1805 campaign of the Third Coalition, and this time Massena defeated Archduke Charles at the Battle of Caldero. Do you think it was around this time that Charles realized the Austrian army needed major reforms, and what were some of those reforms?
The reforms, they start really after they lost Silesia in the Succession War in the 1740s. You get this more important chief of staff, the artillery gets overhauled and it's much lighter. And then they have the major reforms that are usually known as the 1769 reforms, where the chief of staff's role is set out. More clearly, the army's more centralized, more standardized kit and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They actually have drill regulations that are used across the entire army. So that process is going on. And then they set up the Nostitz-Rhenick committee, which later became the Unterberger one, which introduced the 1798 pattern uniform, new muskets, that sort of thing. But what actually happened, it's one of these things because so much of Austria is seen through the French prism.
Right.
There is this idea, of course, the Austrians reacted to their defeat at the hands of Napoleon at Austerlitz and generally in 1805.
Right.
But in actual fact, Charles, at the end of the just after Hohenlinden, in January 1801, he writes a long memorandum to Franz, which famously said, an empire like Austria does not collapse without shaking all of Europe in its death throes, which is pretty prophetic stuff. He said everything needs overhauling: the government, the army, the economy, everything. He actually starts off, he becomes the Minister of War, and he also gets the presidency of the Hofkriegsrath, which is the military administrative body. And he then, the reforms begin then. He's got Mack looking at the infantry and Philip Groen looking at the cavalry.
Right.
And so they were actually preparing the reforms. The problem was the empire was broke, and most of the troops were either on furlough or they were sort of road gangs, and that sort of thing, hired out for civil engineering. So
you and I were talking before the call about the role of the chief of staff, which was really expanded, and it really frees up the commanding general to focus on strategy, where you have this chief of staff who's doing like all the logistics and handling of the men, right? Like it gives him more time to focus on battle.
That's right. I mean, Charles, it was according to Chris Duffy, it was a suggestion by the French ambassador in 1757 that as they didn't have a Prince Eugene of Savoy from the Spanish Succession War, they needed to make the chief of staff more powerful. I don't know how much of that is myth, but they certainly started looking at that because they hadn't got a Prince Eugene. And it suited Charles because of his physical weakness, particularly the fatigue he suffered from. If he had a good chief of staff and good senior staff officers, he could offload the work onto them. I mean, he's got a civilian assistant called Matthias von Fassbender, who does a lot of the civilian work. He arranged for a big survey of the empire, so they had an idea of the empire's resources and all this kind of thing.
No, that's a great example, I think. And Abraham Lincoln did the same thing. He hired men that were more talented than him to kind of carry out his policy.
Right. Yeah. It's the same thing. Charles is quite prepared to delegate. He's the exact opposite of Napoleon, who was kind of had his finger in every pie.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 1809, Austria again went to war with France, and this time, Archduke Charles is a field marshal, and after initial setbacks at Ebensburg, Landshut, and Eckmold, Charles handed Napoleon his first defeat in a decade at the epic Battle of Aspern-Essling. Why was Charles triumphant in this particular battle?
Well, to some extent, actually, it's the chief of staff. He'd had a guy called Prochaska rather foisted upon him at the start of the campaign. Prochaska basically lost his head during Eckmold. He just lost control of it completely.
Mm-hmm.
And once Charles had retreated back into Bohemia, which is sort of now the Western Czech Republic, going back along the northern side of the Danube there,
mm-hmm.
he probably booted Prochaska out of headquarters. And Max Wimpfen, who was then the general adjutant, moved over and became the chief of staff. And he was a more able chief of staff. He wasn't brilliant, but he was more able. And Charles is in a fairly static position at Aspern. He doesn't have to worry too much about his lines of supply. They're basically run back into Bohemia and Moravia, which is the Eastern Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's got more time to focus on the battle. But they do actually, the battle is kind of, that their plan is kind of off balance, because what they thought the French were going to do was come over Lobau and then go up back up the river to Schwarzenlachenau, which is the bridgehead across the old Danube bridges, which they'd been burned.
Mm-hmm.
But they thought they were going to go up there, and so they expected the French to come up through Aspern and then through Herkstetten and then come along the riverbank there.
Right.
And so the idea was like a sort of pincer movement of three of the corps as they came out through Herkstetten. But of course, the French actually only went as far as Aspern.
Yeah, I know Bonapartists will tell me that, you know, Napoleon had the bridges taken out and he was fighting with the river against his back. But, you know, Archduke Charles, that's not his problem. He saw the French army against the river and he attacked, which I think was the right move.
Oh, yeah. He's very much influenced. People tend to forget this, but Charles himself was very influenced by Prince Eugene of Savoy.
Mm-hmm.
And his big victory over the Turks was at a battle called Zenta in 1697. And that was a very similar situation. He caught the Turks kind of halfway across the river.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles actually wrote after the battle, after Aspern, is, "I've maneuvered on this plain as against the Turks." So it's clearly a reference to Zenta.
Right.
But what he did, once they kind of realized what was happening, he knew there was no point really piling in to start straight away.
Mm.
Because if you only defeat 10,000 men, it's not going to make that much difference.
Right.
So he was intent on allowing a reasonable chunk of Napoleon's army over, small enough for him to defeat, but big enough to have an effect on it. But this is, Charles is always open to new ideas.
Right.
Because of his kind of Enlightenment background. When the engineers came to him and said, "Look, they're building these bridges.
Mm-hmm.
What we've got to do is chuck some stones in barges and get some of these water mills," which are like, the water mills are on a river, but they're horizontal rather than vertical, and they just suck them in the river.
Right.
And just set those free as well, let them go down and smash the bridges up. to delay the French coming across. Yeah. But of course, as the French stopped to get the troops across, they start building up in the center, and they try to break out on the 21st and the 22nd. And Charles is having to push Hohenzollern's II Corps out across the plain to hold the French advance. But they initially go in what they call battalion massa, which are closed up columns on company frontage.
Yeah.
So they're 18 ranks deep, and they were getting quite badly smashed up
by
the French artillery. So he was breaking them down into divisions massa, either on a half company or a full company frontage, just so that they could fill the gap.
Yeah.
And not take so much damage from the artillery.
I thought he did a fine job, and I think it was only the heroics of Marshals Massena, Lannes, and Bessier that saved the day. Otherwise, they would have been thrown in the river.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt the French put up an excellent fight, particularly Massena around Aspern, because that really was the key to the position. As soon as the Austrians had secured Aspern on the 22nd, that was it. It was over, because they were just going to move in artillery and just smash the entire French line. And so the Poland had to pull out. But
it's an interesting battle to study, but obviously, Napoleon, you know, kind of gets a bloody nose and he pulls back, you know, into Vienna and Lobau. But oddly, Charles elects not to follow up his victory, and Napoleon has several weeks to call in reinforcements to Vienna and rebuild his army. Why do you think Charles didn't attack Napoleon when he had his back against the wall?
Essentially, it's because he'd taken a lot of casualties and they'd lost a lot in Germany. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really have an awful lot to reinforce his army with. The 3rd Battalions had been marched away just before Aspern. They're in Bohemia for more drill, and they could have them back. But beyond that, it's just the Landwehr Battalions. He's not got that big a force. And, of course, he would have the opposite problem that Napoleon had. He's got to build a bridge somewhere. And the French could do exactly the same thing. They could smash his bridges up and stop him getting across.
Yeah,
but Charles was also, they knew that Wellington was advancing in Portugal, and it was kind of, they weren't sure exactly what the Russians were going to do.
Right.
And so he was kind of hoping, that was one of his failings, was he didn't understand that Napoleon had to win. Mm-hmm. Charles was quite happy to compromise. If there's a victory or a sort of semi-victory or something like that, then they could kind of get together and make a peace treaty and that would be it.
Right.
But of course, Napoleon had to keep winning. He had to be the top dog, otherwise he was out on his ear.
And this all led to the huge Battle of Wagram, which was a very close run loss for the Austrians. And there were many reasons for the loss, including the late arrival of Archduke John to the battlefield. And after a secondary battle at Znaim, peace is declared with France, and Charles gives up all of his military positions. Mm. Was he just sick of war at this point? Was he disgusted with his brothers?
I think it was a combination of things. As I said, when we were talking earlier, he went out on the battlefield at Aspern, and it was in the past he'd always kind of moved on from his battlefields, and they'd been much smaller armies anyway.
Right.
But he saw the devastation, and he wrote a letter actually on the battlefield the day after the battle, and he's obviously shocked by what he sees. Mm-hmm. So many casualties.
Right.
And again, of course, he is even worse at Wagram. Mm-hmm. But really, it was more a case of Franz basically told him to resign. Mm. Franz's kind of attitude was, I'll get a bunch of guys and they'll give me the solution, and they'll, you know, it's all great until it all goes wrong. And then that will get sacked and the new will come in.
Well, it must have been awkward for Charles because, you know, he's the commander of the army and he's always telling Francis to not go to war with Napoleon. Francis ignores him. They go to war with Napoleon and they lose. So Archduke Charles is probably like, look, you don't listen to me. You don't give me enough troops to win these battles. What am I doing out here?
Yeah, I think he had enough of the political infighting as well, because Stadion, the foreign minister, who was also swept away at the end of the war, but Stalin had been giving him a hard time and undermining him during the retreat from Bavaria as well. Mm-hmm. So I think he really just had enough. But Napoleon did ask Metternich to ask him if he would command in 1812. And Charles wrote that he just washed his hands like Pontius Pilate and would have nothing to do with it. But he did offer to command in 1813.
Okay.
And the Tsar was quite keen. But Franz, there's a bit of jealousy. There is this thing about I've swept the previous lot away. I'm going to focus on the new guys. A bit of jealousy and a popular brother. And of course, there were rumors from 1805 that Napoleon had offered Charles the imperial throne.
Ah, interesting.
And so there was quite a lot of suspicion. On the front. He was a naturally sort of suspicious person.
Yeah, I don't blame him. Yeah, so like you mentioned, Austria joins the Sixth Coalition during the 1813-1814 campaign, but Charles is not given a command, and he lives out the rest of his life in retirement. What does he do in his later years? I know he gets married in 1815.
Yeah, he was made the governor of Mainz in West Germany there for a few months in 1815. Mm-hmm. And that's when he met Henrietta Maria of Nassau-Weilburg, who was a local aristocrat. And yes, they were married very quickly. She was only 18 years old. He was 44.
Oh, wow.
It was a very happy marriage.
Good. Did they have children?
They had six children.
Okay.
Unfortunately, she died. She died in 1829.
Okay.
So he was left with six small children.
Yeah.
But he kind of went into retirement anyway. He inherited Duke Albert of Saxe-Teschen's estates. And Albert actually owned the Albertina Palace, which is a very famous art museum because Albert was a big art collector. Mm-hmm. So he was looking after the Albertina as well, and he built a castle which is called the Weilburg. It was destroyed in the Second World War, and it looked like Henrietta's home. He was an avid gardener as well. roses were his particular favorite. But okay. the other thing he did really was he then started writing histories of campaigns that he'd fought and also assessments of other campaigns to instruct his male children in their future military careers.
Okay. Well, I know he passes away in Vienna in 1847, and the next question is kind of a tricky one, but because he lost several battles to Napoleon, but defeated him once and defeated several of his marshals. Mm-hmm. What do you think his legacy was?
I think it's a hidden legacy. It is the problem with Austria is that it's been clouded out because of the wars of the 20th century have made many writers turn away from Germanic sources. And so they don't see that this is where the modern general staff starts.
Right.
That Charles is developing it. And so the chief of staff becomes a real kingpin. It's not that mythology of Napoleon and Berthier. Mm-hmm. And also that they did... Meyer, who was the chief of staff in the run-up to the 1809 war, he looks very closely at the corps system, and they do try and set up a corps system as it will be developed by the Prussians later on. Charles said he wanted his corps commanders to know what he wanted just from the look on his face.
Right.
So he is it is this devolving the power out as well. So people don't realise what he left behind, and also in his writings, there was a guy called Halleck, I think, in the American Civil War. Mm-hmm. And he was the only one who followed Charles, and they all reputedly had a copy of Jomini in their pockets. Mm. But Jomini actually translated Charles's works on 1796 and 1799. So it's an interesting question that's never been gone into. How much was Jomini influenced by translating Charles's work?
Right.
It's not just that he was the synthesis of Napoleonic warfare.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier before the call, just I think the Austrian army, you know, obviously they lose to Napoleon several times. And I think they're depicted as these, the generals at least, as these bumbling fools, but they weren't. They were talented soldiers and generals in the Austrian army.
Yes, they were. I mean, a lot of them had fought in the Seven Years' War, but they were getting older. But you do have, a lot of it is down to the chiefs of staff. You need to look more closely at them. People say Charles is his performance is uneven. Well, look at who his chiefs of staff were.
Right.
When he had a good one, he was fine. When he didn't, it all went a bit horribly wrong.
And you touched on something earlier that, you know, it wasn't just like all of France going to war with a bunch of Frenchmen who spoke French. You know, this was many different nationalities in the Austrian army who didn't all speak the same language.
Yeah, they couldn't, for obvious reasons, they couldn't appeal to nationalism in the way that the French could. They couldn't, because of this kind of balancing act, the Austrian monarch, later became the Austrian emperor in 1804, there's a balancing act. There's certain areas in the west of the empire are pretty much under kind of fairly absolute rule. Although there are sort of assemblies and that sort of thing. But you go out into the east, the Hungarian Diet, which was a kind of a noble assembly, bishops and other landowners and that sort of thing, it's very powerful itself, and the nobles didn't want their sort of biggest, toughest blokes being dragged away from agricultural work and being taken into the army and sort of never coming back.
Right.
And so it was very limited, what they could get from Hungary. They had to agree that a certain number of Hungarian troops would be in the army, and then the requisite level of volunteers that would have to be taken each year to keep the Hungarian section up, up to size. So there are these limits. I mean, Charles was all in favour of expanding conscription in 1802 as part of his initial reforms of the army.
Yeah.
But that was viewed as a step too far, and the Hungarians were obviously going to resist it.
Right.
And you've got populations of Serbs and Poles and people like that that part of them are in the empire and part of them are outside the empire.
Right.
And so there was almost that pull away as well.
Yeah. Well, I think Charles did as well as any of the Austrian generals, and in his fights against, the genius that was Napoleon. So I just don't think he gets enough credit for what he did accomplish in his commanding days.
No, he doesn't. It tends to be, he defeated Napoleon at Aspern, but yes, as Napoleon said, it was the Danube that defeated us.
Right.
And it is his focus on limited war.
Right.
Has, of course, come back into fashion more since about 1945.
Yep.
And that's, but yeah, there is no English biography of him.
Right. Well, that might be your next book right there. There you go.
yeah, I've tried two or three times. It gets so complicated because people aren't familiar with the sort of cast of characters.
Right. Yeah.
Let alone the political system and everything else.
Yeah.
It's not an easy job.
No, I know firsthand. It's a lot to cover. Well, thank you, Dave, for all of that. That was a great overview, very informative. And again, if you'd like to buy some of Dave's books, anywhere you can find books or books that he's contributed to, is David A. Hollins is the author's name. And thank you, my friend. That was really great stuff.
A pleasure talking to you, John. And thank you for running your podcast. I know how much work that you and Alex and others put into these podcasts. So I'm quite happy to contribute and bang the drum for Austria, as I've said elsewhere.
Well, I appreciate you banging that drum for Austria and for the podcast. So thank you, Dave. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks very much. Bye-bye, John.